or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live, your weekly roundup of, well, good heavens, just about the best of everything in the world of IT. We're always happy to talk about what's been going on at Information Week and other places in the IT world. And today we have a roundtable that is high on quality, even if it's not big on quantity. I'm joined this week by my fellow executive editor at Information Week, Dave Wagner. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm always pleased to have you join us, and it's interesting because it seems to me that one of the interesting things that was going on this week were some talks about some skills. Now, we've been talking about the Internet of Things and the kind of skills you need to have if you're going to be a successful player in the IoT. And you had an article on that very topic this week. What kind of skills did you find people need? I mean, I would tend to think of things like soldering and other stuff, but I suspect your list was a bit different.
Yeah, it was a little bit different. What I did is I found a study that was done by Accenture and Fjord, not Ford like the motor company, Fjord, the design company, like the Norwegian Fjords. And they were talking about how design of Internet of Things products is going to change in the next few years. And as I read that article, it made me realize that there are an awful lot of skills that are about to be in demand on a level that we don't normally have in IoT or in IT in general right now. One of the things they correctly pointed out, I think, is that our current brand of smart products really aren't that smart. Most of them are programmed on a if-then-then-that kind of scenario. So, for instance, your smart thermostat, if the family has all left the house, then turn the air conditioning down, right? Those are the kinds of really simple, basic ideas that most smart products are built on. But what they're saying, and I think they're correct, is that the next generation of IoT products are going to start taking some of the basic decision load off of people. And when they do that, they're going to become smarter. They're going to start having a certain amount of what we would call artificial intelligence. And to do that, they need to be designed according to Accenture and Fjord as data first, designed by the data that you need to incorporate to make those decisions, and make that input as low human as possible, as low a friction requirement for the humans to input that data as possible. And doing that, it struck me that there are a few things that are going to change. And the first is that there's not going to be such a thing as an IT person who is not a data scientist. We were already heading that way. We're getting close. But when you start designing products to be data-driven first, it means that anybody from the network administrator to the UX designer to the server manager has to think about data first. And the other thing that it struck me is it means we're going to need an awful lot more people who are experts in artificial intelligence. Not necessarily the sort of grand artificial intelligence we think of like from Watson. But we're going to start needing people who have an understanding of how to program, if I get this data, I should make this kind of reaction. And that's a change in the kinds of skill sets that we currently have in IT and in software development today, and I think it's going to be a big deal.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about that, because that seems to be the direction that Gartner and a lot of the other analysts seem to think we're going to be going, that we want to augment the intelligence of humans. And in order to do that, we need to take those poor, fallible humans out of the equation as much as possible. I thought it was interesting at a Gartner symposium, either this most recent one last October or the one before that, they were talking about a fundamental shift occurring. Right now, we have human beings who tend to be in the decision-making loop as checks to make sure that the machine intelligence hasn't done anything wrong. And they think that's going to flip, that we're going to go more and more towards it being the automated systems that are considered to be more reliable than the humans. Is that the kind of sense of things that you were seeing in your research?
Well, I do think that that's going to happen, but I think this is this particular study was focused a little bit more on the consumer product. And what I think they're trying to do, or what they're saying that we're trying to do, and I think this makes a lot of sense, is right now, practically every new technology that comes out adds a burden to a human. There's something new. There are things that are helpful about them, but they also add a new burden. A phone or a watch or whatever, while they're trying to be convenient, they also add a sort of new layers of input required from you, right, to make them work. What they think is going to happen is that the next generation of products are going to start taking the burden off people. So, for instance, I come home and I come home and I like my lighting low, and I like a certain playlist, and I want to cook dinner, right? And I want to relax. Well, right now, even though I might have a smart refrigerator, although I don't yet, that has a smart refrigerator that tells me what I can make, and I have lighting that I can set for certain things and temperatures and playlists, I still have to do a lot of inputting to make all of that happen, right? The next generation is going to understand that I've come home from work and that these are my preferences. And they're going to adjust based on the idea, oh, hey, instead of coming home from work alone today, he's got company. He's got five other people in the room. Maybe he's not going to want the relaxed mode. Maybe he wants party mode. And they're going to make those decisions for us. And we can, of course, override them. But by doing that kind of thinking, it takes some of the technology burden off. Funny enough, by automating it with a computer, the attempt is to make it more human, to make it easier, to make it live organically with people. Basically, what we're trying to find is another human brain. And so I think that that's an extension of what you're talking about in a more enterprise setting of letting the computers take some of the burden off of humans. But it's a slightly different concept. But I think it's a really important step for the Internet of Things, or else it really doesn't make a lot of sense.
Very, very cool. Well, you know, it's interesting. We've been getting a lot of people reading our articles and commenting on our articles around this whole notion of learning about the Internet of Things. I had a piece recently on platforms where you could learn IoT concepts, and I was pleasantly surprised at the number of responses we got and the number of people who read that piece. It seems like one of the things that's going on is that a lot of people, whether for their work or just for their own sense of curiosity, really want to know about this. And I suspect that's going to be the case for quite some time to come. I think it's fascinating that we've got yet another one of those topics where it can be a little difficult for a lot of people differentiating between their hobby and their career. And if history is any gauge, that's where we tend to get a lot of creativity going on in the industry.
We do. That's my favorite thing about our current generation of technology, is that for a while there, I felt like we had gotten to the point where it was really expensive for a hobbyist to get involved. And I think the pendulum's swinging the other way, and it's really exciting. I think the garage innovator is back, and I'm really excited about that. And one of the best parts about that is the Internet of Things is getting cheaper and cheaper. That's the reason it's going to work, right? Is that some of these sensors are going to cost a dollar to make and to connect devices. And very few people are going to have trouble affording that. And I just got a report today in my email, and I didn't check the veracity of this number, but the report said that the Internet of Things was going to add $1.35 trillion to the economy in the next 10 years. I don't know if that number is accurate, but the number is large. Let's put it that way, right? And so one of the best parts about that is we're poised to have regular people get a larger share of that pie than some of the other products that have come out in the last few years.
Well, I certainly hope that that I can skim off just a little bit of that. It would do wonders for my retirement fund.
Yeah, I'll take 10%, really. That's all I'm asking.
Hey, a mere pittance. Well, you know, one of the interesting things about the Internet of Things is that people have started talking about the security implications of all these intelligent devices out there. And this has been a week where the word on security hasn't been particularly good around the industry. I mean, we keep getting people saying that there are vulnerabilities in platforms, whether they're, you know, Apple or Android, and the mess that is the Office of Personnel Management and its growing security debacle is truly sobering. I guess my question to you is, when you look at all of these, do you think we're anywhere close to a point where security concern starts to put a brake on some of the growth in the development?
The intelligent answer here is yes, right? The intelligent answer is always security should be the first thing we think about. The reality, though, is I think that this is a boulder rolling down a hill, and our exuberance for the trillion-dollar industry is too large not to keep that boulder rolling. The one thing I have to say is one of our, and I apologize for not remembering, but one of our very astute readers on Information Week made a very interesting point about IoT and security. And he said that while there are going to be millions of new attack vectors, the surface area of each one of those vectors is rather small. And that one of the benefits to that is that the loopholes are relatively easy to close. Now, I'm no security expert, and I don't claim to be, but if that is so, I'd like to think that just a little bit of responsible forethought could go a long way. And of course, that's asking a lot. But I don't know, what do you think? You have a lot more experience than I do with security. Where do you think, is the Internet of Things just opening up a million new vectors we're never going to close? Or do you think that's something we can manage?
Well, you know, I think that to some extent, the Internet of Things has the same security profile as the giant school of anchovies that migrates up the coast of Africa every year. If you have 10 billion of these things out there, the likelihood of some predator in the form of a hacker picking off a lot of them is pretty small, because they don't know which one is the tastiest. And you would have to say that, again, to keep this rather bizarre analogy going a little longer, your strategic posture becomes trying to make sure you're at the center of the bait ball. So I suspect we're going to see lots of that kind of activity going on. to be brutally honest, I don't think we're going to see security taking a big hit on the activity around either Internet of Things or big data or, frankly, anything else. There's simply too much money to be made on the efficiency that computers inject into the working environment. And so I think we're going to have the occasional CIO, you know, thrown out as the sacrificial wounded sardine to the regulators. We're going to see people paying fines and losing court cases, pardon me, and paying those fines and paying the settlements because they will have done the calculations that say essentially that it's more cost effective to have the computer systems in place and to pay those judgments than it is not to have the computer systems in place. As long as that's true, we're going to see people forging ahead and all of these technology trends just marching right along.
Right, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. The one thing that bothers me about that is that while the occasional CIO does lose their job, what you're actually describing is the sardines that are really getting thrown out to the edge are the consumer, right? I mean, like, while Target loses its customer data and pays a fine, and not a very big one in my opinion, pays a fine and a few people lose their job, the real losers are the millions of people whose data was lost and gets used to do whatever. And that frightens me, and it does make me wonder if one day a government doesn't wake up and say, wait a minute, enough's enough, this can't happen this way, and they start to change the economic realities of this. But truthfully, I agree with you in general that that we're making the equation has not changed in the number of years that I've covered this industry. There's always more economic benefit to the innovation than there is to the economic benefit of the person who's exploiting it. So it's sort of the cost of doing business. It's similar to knowing that a certain amount of your stock is going to go out the door from shoplifters in a retail setting. It's just part of the cost of doing business.
Well, I have to agree that cost of doing business, and it reminds me in many ways of the old things we heard about, where the automakers would do the calculations that it was less expensive to pay the judgments of the families of people who died than it was to spend a buck and a quarter to actually fix a problem in the vehicle. I hope that we don't see security problems reaching anything like that level of severity, but I fear that before long something truly awful is in fact going to happen. That's just my thought. Well, let's we can find something happier to talk about. Surely there are happier things to talk about. And one of the other articles, you know, the Apple Watch started to be sold in Apple stores this week, and that means that it's time for people to say, well, gee, why pay any attention to the Apple Watch? What you really want is the Apple Watch 2.
Exactly.
And there have been some interesting speculation about that. One of my favorites is the video camera, where you can really start doing the Dick Tracy thing and having, you know, video chat on your watch. What do you think about all that? Are you ready to put on your yellow fedora and start doing video chats from your wrist?
My biggest fear is how large my nose is going to appear on a video that I'm holding to my wrist. But No, I mean, we know for sure that we're going to get to do audio, right? They said that at the Mobile World Congress. And that created the expectation of the video. I for one, question, I mean, like, people seem to still not understand what the watch is for. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it'll create innovation. But my understanding was that the reason for the watch was so that you could do things on it when you didn't have your phone out. Like it would tell you when you had a text, it would monitor certain information, right? Well, if it's a complement to the phone, I'm not quite sure why I want to pay more for a better watch that is doing something my phone already can do very well. On the other hand, if the watch is to replace the phone, it makes total sense to me. So I think right now we're still trying to figure out what the watch is for. And when we have that answer, I think a lot of other things are going to fall into place.
Now, you know, I'll agree with you, but I have to say I'm working on an article right now. I've got a little wrist thing. I'm not going to call it a watch because it's not really primarily a watch. But Oregon Scientific, the company that makes all sorts of home weather stations and other things, sent me this little Fitbit sort of thing. And I've been wearing it the past week or two. And it does a very small subset of what the Apple Watch is supposed to do. It keeps track of my daily, you know, activities and all that. But it also links from my phone and will buzz on my wrist when certain things happen on my phone. If a text message comes in, if I get a phone call, if I get certain kinds of activities on the social media or even certain kinds of emails come in, it will buzz, and on its tiny little screen, a message will scroll across, and it tells me what has just come in. I am finding that I like that a lot, because whether I'm in the car or out walking around with my phone in my pocket, I am entirely capable of missing a lot of alerts that come in on my phone. I don't know if it's just that my hip has gone numb or my ears have gotten bad or both, but I'm entirely capable of missing them. But I don't miss when my wrist buzzes. And so I'm finding that I enjoy that part of it very much. And I have to say that after wearing this thing for a few days, I am considerably more intrigued by the idea of an Apple Watch than I was, say, 3 weeks ago.
Well, let me ask you something. Is that little device by Oregon Scientific the same cost as an Apple Watch or less?
It's less. It's I think the one that I'm wearing now, the retail price on it is in the neighborhood of $100.
See, now that makes sense to me. I might be willing to pay $100 for what you described. I believe the Apple Watch, the cheaper ones are in the $400 range.
Yeah, $350 to $400, somewhere
right
in there.
So this is what I think Apple's problem is, right? Is right now, the Apple Watch is essentially the product you just described, plus a few buzzers and whistles, and I'll admit that some of those are pretty nifty. But it's four times the cost, right? What Apple needs to do is one of two things, and I know what Apple will do. They either need to reduce the cost to justify what it does, or they need to raise the capabilities to justify the cost. And when they raise the capabilities to justify the cost, and this is clearly what they're trying to do with FaceTime, then they start to get into the territory where they're in competition with themselves. They're in competition with their phone. And that is an extremely interesting and dangerous place for them to be. Because right now they're trying to convince people to essentially carry around these two devices that total and cost about $1,000 in retail, not counting subsidies from phone contracts and those sorts of things, right? But the closer the two of them get in capability, the less one needs to pay for both. And so I think they're in a really interesting situation. And if I were them, I would try to do the opposite. I would try to reduce costs and get it to more like the product you just described.
Well, the only argument that I would make counter to that is that I suspect that Apple has learned a lesson from the iPad. And if you'll recall, from the time the iPad was first introduced, people said, no one will buy it. I mean, why would you have this? You've already got your laptop. You've already got your phone. Why would you need a tablet? And lots and lots of pundits kept trying to say, well, people will only carry one thing. So the tablet is going to have to take over the laptop. Or that the laptop has to be just like the tablet. And as a matter of fact, Microsoft has spent years trying to make that happen. Apple took the point of view that people would happily carry both screens and use them for different things. And I think that what they probably are doing is seeing the same kind of relationship with the phone and the watch. Not that it's an either or, but that people will carry both and use them for somewhat different things. In other words, people have started using their phones as video consumption centers. People, and I know I've done this. I have a new iPhone 6 Plus, and I'm using it to watch a lot of YouTube videos and videos from news sites and other things. I would never try to do that on anything that will logically fit on my wrist. On the other hand, there are lots of things where, to use a phrase that my dear wife used years ago, someone doesn't really want to talk to me, they just want to tell me something. And for those applications, and there are a lot of those, the watch would work much better than having to, you know, reach into my pocket, fish out my phone, and deal with it, especially if I'm either in a social situation or, you know, sitting at a traffic light, waiting for the light to change. It's nothing to glance at my wrist. It's quite a big deal and illegal in most places to dig in my pocket and pull out my phone.
Right, but what you're describing, again, is Apple Watch 1. Apple Watch 2's main additions are things that go from somebody wants to tell me something to somebody wants to talk to me. And that's what makes it interesting, and that's what makes it different, right, is I absolutely get the Apple 1, or the Apple Watch 1. What I'm trying to get is, Once you add cost to add the camera, you're changing it from a notification device to a communication device.
Yes, but you still need the phone because you don't have the, you know, edge or you know, the cell capable radio in that watch, and you're not going to because all of a sudden the already present battery problems become utterly unmanageable.
Right, although they are adding Wi-Fi to that, which will allow for an awful lot of calls. But what I think basically we're getting at here is I think what we all agree on is that there are X number of form factors, right? What we saw, what the iPad and the tablet have done, they haven't killed the watch or the phone. They've killed the desktop PC, and they're killing the laptop, right? I mean, to a certain degree, it's a long death. I mean, let's face it, it's going to be a long time till we get rid of them all. But the sales of laptops and desktops are going down, 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 right? So what they did is they killed the big screen first. Once those dinosaurs are gone, people are going to look at the tablet, the watch, and the phone a little differently than they do now, I think.
That's entirely possible, although, you know, I have to admit I still love my laptop, and I love my external screen, but then again, I do a fair amount of photography and video work, and I'm having trouble thinking about editing a video on my wristwatch. That's just one of those
right.
things that that may be a bridge too far.
Right. What I think we're going to see eventually is that it's a bring-your-own-computer in the sense that I don't know whether it's going to be my phone, my watch, my tablet, but I think there's going to be a point where there's one thing I can carry around in my pocket that I can plug into a monitor, I can plug into my television, I can plug into my smart refrigerator, I can plug into my phone. I take my computer with me, right? And then I use the cloud as my storage device. This thing I carry around with me recognizes me and the apps that I want to use in the cloud and whatever I hook it into, right? So if I need to edit a video on a large screen, I plug this little thing into the screen and I go, right? I don't know the exact way it's going to come down, but that's what I'm visualizing, is that the cloud is going to mean that I can bring myself with me and plug it into whatever I need to plug it into.
Well, speaking of bringing your own, let's talk about the geek end. This is always my favorite thing to talk about every week. And I know that this week you've been talking a lot about E3, the big video game extravaganza going on down in Southern California. So what's the geek end about this week?
The geek end is about my favorite games that came out from E3, both the ones that will come out this fall that we got to see real detail about, and the games that we can expect in the next couple of years. And it is a pairing with another E3 article I did about the larger trends coming out from E3, including we got to see the first demos of virtual reality games this year, which was pretty exciting, especially for people who like VR. And we got to see what I think is going to be the future of the console wars for the next couple of years as well. So lots of big trends and lots of fun, specific video games. If you're into gaming at all, it's a great read. And if you're not into gaming, but you're into the business of IT or of technology, it's also still a good read, I think.
Very cool. Now, I'm curious, in terms of the overall gaming market, is that still growing the way it was a few years ago? I know that according to my son, who's the game development and game design maven, there's been a shakeout in the consoles, but it sounds to me like consoles don't matter quite the way they once did. Am I too far behind the curve here?
Well, it's an interesting thing. What this year, somewhere around August of this year, mobile gaming is going to pass console gaming in revenue for the first time ever. So mobile gaming is making console gaming take a little bit of a backseat, because what the difference between the two is basically consoles have a high entry cost, right? So usually anybody who's willing to pay $400 for the latest generation console is a pretty hardcore gamer. And those people are willing to shell out a lot of money for the biggest titles of the year. And that's still what E3 is mostly about. Mobile gaming is a frontier, and it's a fascinating one. It's a frontier from two points of view. Both the customers themselves, many of them are casual gamers who are willing to pay 99 cents or $4.99 or even just watch ads to play a free game, but they're not willing to chunk down $60. And so you have an industry which has customers who have never played games before and are wowed by things that hardcore gamers would yawn at. You also have an interesting situation, which is that it is extremely easy for an independent gaming company to rise out of nowhere with the right game. So you'll get people who come up with the right game who become instant millionaires and billionaires overnight. And so the industry hasn't been consolidated to knock out the little guy yet. So you have a lot of innovation. But E3, when I think about it, I still think about it as console and PC. Interestingly enough, people don't think this way because of the kinds of blockbuster titles that come out on console, but PC is still by far the largest monetary place for gaming. It's Microsoft just admitted a major mistake. For years, the PC gaming has been left to go a little fallow because of their obsession with winning the console wars with Sony. But they just combined their Windows gaming studio with their Xbox gaming studio, and they're now just thinking of it as Windows 10 gaming. And the reason for that is because they admit it. They screwed up. They were letting their largest gaming industry, PC gaming, pretty much alone and to fend for itself while they were obsessed with Xbox. So we're really in a fascinating place when it comes to gaming right now, and that's not even including that virtual reality might shake the whole thing up.
Well, one of the things that it seems like we're getting closer to, and I'm curious to hear if they talked about this much at E3, is the fabled Oculus Rift seems to be getting closer and closer to being an actual product rather than this thing that's been out there in development forever. When you're talking about virtual reality, is Oculus Rift really where all the action is going to be, or do you think this is one of those things that's been talked to death and will never live up to the hype that's been building?
Well, right now, the big, hot virtual reality headset for gaming is the Morpheus for PlayStation. And that is, I don't know if that will be the final name. It's still Project Morpheus is its code name. It may have a different name when it hits the market. But at E3, Sony debuted at least three, and probably more, but there were three that hit my radar, high-end games for the Morpheus headset that were extremely visually stimulating. One of the things that people have feared with virtual reality helmets in the past, Nintendo tried a virtual reality gaming headset, going on 25 years ago now, they feared graphical problems. And we have solved the graphics problem on our virtual reality helmets to the point that they are very close to what you would get from a PC experience. I did not get my hands on, I couldn't go to E3 this year, I have not gotten my hands on a game yet from the Morpheus to know if it plays well, but it sure looks fantastic, and it moves really well on the screen. So right now, Morpheus has a lead on Oculus Rift from that point of view, and also so does HoloLens, Microsoft's helmet, because HoloLens is being paired with Minecraft, which is one of the biggest games out there right now. So we'll see how Oculus Rift fires back. But Oculus Rift has a different goal in mind. Project Morpheus is definitely built for gaming and gaming only. I'm sure we'll have entertainment and things added to it, but it is a gaming device. Oculus Rift is really designed as an entertainment device. It will have gaming, but they're aiming it at movie manufacturers, they're aiming it at marketing. They're really going after a bigger pie than Sony is, and so is Microsoft with the HoloLens, which they think actually would work in an office setting. So we'll see. I think it's easier for Sony to get a lead than necessarily to keep that lead.
Well, there's still lots to follow, and it's interesting. We had a comment over in the text message, our text conversation, that E3 is one of these sort of rolling stories because some of the things we're talking about this year were actually announced last year and are only becoming products this year, and that seems to be a pattern that repeats over and over and over again.
Yeah. in fact, one of the biggest announcements this year was for a game called The Last Guardian. And the funny thing about The Last Guardian is that it was originally announced at E3 in 2009 and for the PlayStation 3. And it was actually started in production in 2007. And people have been joking that it was announced for the PlayStation 3. They bought a PlayStation 3 because they were excited to play that game. Now it's being announced for PlayStation 4, and some have joked they want to just pre-order the PlayStation 5 right now so that they can play Last Guardian when it finally comes out. So that is definitely a true thing about E3. But that's not that different than any entertainment cycle, right? I mean, how long have we heard about Star Wars Episode 7? And we're still 6 months away from it coming out, right? So there's always a cycle. Who's going to be involved in the game / movie, right? Who's going to be the cast? Who's the director? What's the story, right? Who's designing the game? What is the game about? Is the early story, right? And then it goes, they make it, and then now they've made it, there's a new story. Hey, this is when it's coming out. This is what it's like. We're really excited about it. You know, so there's nothing really wrong with that from E3, but it is true that every once in a while a video game will run into a major problem, and it will become kind of comical. So of the 10, or I think there are actually more. I think there are 15 games that I highlighted in my Geekend today. I will guarantee you that at least one will end up never coming out. Or it will come out years from now and will be a major bomb because somebody said, well, geez, we've spent all these millions on it. We need to put it out. But you'll notice I put an ETA for every game in the story, and almost all of them come with question marks. And the reason is because of the reality of putting together big blockbuster video games.
Well, it seems like there's plenty more that we're going to be hearing about, but I'm afraid we're going to have to wait until another episode of Information Week Live to do that. We're at the close of this one, and so we're going to go around our discussion table to find out what everybody's got coming up in the coming week. Dave, I think we'll go first to you. And I know that you have been just an absolute machine cranking out articles for the past few weeks. I am in awe of all of the stories that you're getting up on Information Week. What do you have planned for the week ahead?
Yeah, actually for Sunday, funny enough, I have an article coming out about Apple Watch rumors. 10 Apple Watch rumors that I wish were around that aren't, actually. That should be a fun read. That's going to come out Sunday morning. Monday, I'm going to have a story about where big data is failing CFOs. I think that should be a really good story. And I want just to take a second. I'm not getting paid for this, but I just want to take a second to shout out the game No Man's Sky. Please check out this game on my site and then check it out on the reality. I have never been more excited about a video game in my entire life. It's coming out this fall. Please, please check out No Man's Sky because this is a small indie developer that's going to make what I think is going to be the greatest video game of all time, and I don't want them to go bankrupt before they get a chance to do it. So I'm sorry about that. I'm not getting paid for it, but I needed to throw that in there real quick.
Well, glad you did, and I'll certainly let folks know. Well, when you're not waiting for No Man's Sky, where can people keep up with what you're doing on social media and in the Tweety Pipes?
Yeah, sure. Find me on Twitter at GeekendDave. That's weekend with a G. And you can find my stuff in the IT Life section of Information Week and also on allanalytics.com.
Very good. Well, thanks for being with us today, Dave. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Kurt.
And as for me, I've had a number of things out this week. Had a review of a wonderful Sennheiser headphone that not only makes you sound great, but makes you look like an utter geek. please check that out. And also, I've got a piece coming out on Sunday looking at what I call the once and future COBOL. What's going on with COBOL development? And as part of that, I'll give you a little preview. I have found a COBOL compiler that runs on the Raspberry Pi. So you can build a CICS-compatible accounting system on a computer that lives in an Altoids 10. In addition, we've got a neat little project that we've started here at Information Week. I had an article on this week. What's in your IT bag? In other words, for everybody who's out there in the world of IT, what are the tools that you carry with you each and every day? We'd love to know, and we had a couple of examples in the article, and in our online discussion, I've just posted a link to a Flickr group. We'd really like it. Take a picture of your bag and its contents. Let us know what's in it. We'd just like to see what kind of bags people carry, what they put in them, what works, what doesn't. I think there should be some interesting stuff out there. So please check that out. And you can check out me and everything that I'm writing on Twitter at KG4GWA. Would really like it if you would do that. Well, for Dave Wagner and everybody here at Information Week Live and Information Week, thanks so much for listening. You'll find us here every week at 3 p.m. Eastern for Information Week Live. If you're listening to this in a streaming version, thanks. But we'd love to have you as part of our great online discussion while we're doing this live. You can find our URL every week on informationweek.com. Please come and check us out. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great weekend. I'm Kurt Franklin. We'll see you next time.